Oh, yes, my friends. It's the Sharon Sleeve Show.
Take my hat, take my coat, take my gloves, I'll take a cup. Take my money, but I'm begging, please don't take my suit. Take my shoe. Take my house, take my clothes, take my wife, lighten up my load. Take my feet, you can take my toes, but please don't take my suit.
From the downtowniest part of New York City, the city that never sleeps, the city that never weeps, the city where nothing keeps. Coming to you live on WCJD 90.2, New York, high atop the Empire State Building.
Just thought I wouldn't talk for a while. Just let it go. Let it all roll out. Let a little river rolling out. Bird song rolling out. Radio signals rolling out. We're all rolling out. I'm wearing... I don't know how this could possibly be true. But someone wrote to me and they said, why aren't you wearing your hat? I like to listen to you when you're wearing your hat. And you haven't been wearing it. And I want to know why. I want to know if you will wear it while you do the Radio Ghost Show. So, and I haven't been wearing it. I have not. When I go walking, I wear a wintry hat. Sometimes I wear the fedora. But not usually when I'm doing this. I take my hat, take my coat, take my gloves, I'll take a cup. That's how it is. I take them all off, have a cup of tea here, usually hatlessly. It's a little more difficult to drink tea with a hat. Did you know that? Everything's more difficult with a hat. It's the most awkward and cumbersome of the clothing articles. Doesn't really make much sense, especially the fancier, nicer hats. They tend to float a bit on the head. They're not quite tight. You don't want them tight. You don't want that choking experience that a necktie can give, or a bow tie. You want a nice hat to sit nicely on your head, like a pillow on a bed, comfortably. But that brings up so many other problems. Wind, getting in. You would be surprised how many times I walk in to a store and something strikes it off in the door frame. Now, it could be that I don't open doors wide enough. I tend to just open it just right for myself to sneak in. Unless I have to be polite, in which case I make a grand show of opening the door to its fullest potential. All the way to the glass I'll bring it out. Sometimes a little bow, something with the hand. Because when I'm polite, I am polite. I don't want to do a little, here it is for you, I'm throwing you the door like a tennis ball that came over my side of the fence. No, no. This is a gentleman's show at that moment, and I'm going to perform it. Because what other... We don't have many of these the bits, the dancey bits that they had in the old days. The old days, they're always dancing around, bowing and winking and nodding and touching their hats and rubbing their vests. All these signals. It's like if you watch a baseball game, the third base coach is there, doing all sorts of mysterious semaphore-like language. He's telling everybody everything. Of course, nobody knows what he's talking about, but he's trying. Have you ever watched that third base coach? That is the closest approximation to what it would be like to living in the 18th century. because that's all people did back then. Little winks and brushes and sign language here and there. It's full of gestures. We've lost most of our gestures. So when I get the chance opening a door, I will, for that moment, inhabit the grand gesture. So I'm wearing my hat now. Here's my hat. I hope you are satisfied. I don't know if I sound particularly hatty, but maybe I do. Maybe there's a different spirit. A lot of people think that if you wear a suit, it makes you stand taller and makes you act differently. You might be a different person in a suit than you're just wearing shorts and galoshes and a silly shirt with a picture of a banana on it. So, possibly, this very hatty episode will be a lot like the grand gesture, the polite gesture I make when I open the door, make a big show out of it. No one, of course, notices. They're halfway through the door as I'm bowing and my hand is fluttering. I often whisper under my breath, if it's a woman, I will say, Your Majesty. If it's a man, I'll say, Highness. And I'll bow my head down. Highness. I can't show you that the hand. It looks like I'm trying to cut up bread with my hand midair. So, where are we? I'm reading Moby Dick. Nobody said they wanted me to read any more, so I'm saying that you're done with it. Now, the interesting thing was I read from the Kindle. The Kindle. And I thought I read a good 20 pages of it. I found my actual real hard copy finally and opened it up, and I had read about a page and a half. Page and a half. On the Kindle, I just kept flicking through the pages. I was really moving along. So I'm reading Moby Dick. I've been freed from the curse of the tweet. But one pleasant bit of fallout from the whole thing. But so I posted on Facebook the prior episode, Moby Dick versus the Fail Whale, and Chris Marshall up in Littleton, who's very close to me here in Lemon, wrote, posted, tweeted, whatever it is, I'm a descendant of Valentine Pease, the only whaling captain Herman Melville served under in his short career, as a seaman. And he posted a link to some bit of Herman Melville lore. I'll read. Among the great stories of the early 1800s is the maritime disaster of the great whaling ship Essex, which was rammed and sunk by a whale. There were stories of mysterious white whales swimming in the sea, stories of crazed captains. Even though Melville is not known to have set foot on the vineyard prior to writing this book, his life was most certainly affected by the people of this island and the stories of their adventures that circulated around the globe. Melville based a good part of his writings on his experiences. As a young man, he went to sea on several ships. 4 days after Christmas and a cold day in December of 1840, Herman Melville, 21, signed his name on the list of men composing the crew of the whaling ship Acushnet of Fairhaven. Valentine Pease, 43, of Edgartown, was captain of the vessel. And this is where the strongest link arises between Moby Dick and the vineyard. Historians have spent the last 150 years wondering just how close Captain Pease was to Melville's Captain Ahab. Certainly, Melville served under no other whaling captain in his short career as a seaman, so it begs the question. I won't go on from there. But how lovely is that? That Captain Ahab's great-great, possibly great, maybe great, another one, grandson, lives just a few minutes away from me here. Lazy the Kid. That's what we call him. Lazy the Kid. right now to roll along, long, long road. Now it's right pretty lonely as alone as that long road. And I know my baby's waiting, and I know my baby's crazy, but she knows that I'm a loner, that I'm shy, that I'm lazy.
Yeah.
I'm lazy in the kill, riding where I did. I got some things to hear, but first to rest these men. Lazy the kid, he rides off into the lazy sunset on a lazy horse on a lazy Sunday afternoon. So that actually was a song that Chris asked me to write a while back. And little did I know that I was writing a song for the great, 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 great-great-grandson of Captain Ahab, the old sea madman himself. I don't think it's that many greats. I don't mean to push him that far away. It's probably a great-great-great. And I'm curious. I was hoping maybe to talk to him at some point, find out about this, find out what he knows about Valentine Peace, although from what I read, there's not much known. But, you know, families sometimes know that which others don't. Maybe even certain things, rumors, speculation, things that people don't want to print because they can't ascertain them for sure in old ship logs and documents. Or maybe he knows nothing at all except that fact, which is fine. I would be happy to call him and say, "So, you are a descendant of Valentine Pease, Lazy the Kid." And Lazy the Kid could say, "Yes, I am." And I could say, "Thank you for calling." And that would be that. Chris Marshall, Lazy the Kid, also did a very nice Photoshop picturegram. It's a reliable image, however, of me down at the Lemon train station. The train is going by, you can see the Lemon train station in the background. Snow is falling and I'm, of course, looking off in the wrong direction, about to miss the train or be run over by it, or both. You can miss the train and be run over by it at the same time, which would be just my fate, my sad fate. Ticket in my hand, run right down. So I went for a walk up Mount Grief the other day, and I thought I'd bring the recorder with me. And about halfway up, I found myself getting very dizzy. And I do get dizzy from time to time. I've always gotten dizzy, ever since I was a boy. I tend to forget it. I get dizzy, I get lightheaded, I sit down, I feel very strange, not myself. And I kind of push through it. And then it's gone, and it's a medical amnesia. I think people do this with the stubborn problems that they might have. And then it comes back and it feels like you always do. So anyway, I go up Mount Grief halfway up. It was very cold. And I get dizzy and I lay down. And as you, if you're young, when you get older, you do this too. You think you're about to pass away. Why not? You're close enough. Something's happening. Something disturbing. And dizziness doesn't feel like you're going in the right direction. Feels like you're being spun up into the tornado towards the clouds or drilled down into the earth. So, when one feels dizzy and one is close to ancient, one begins to think, this could very well be it, Highness. And so one makes the little preparations. What do I want to be thinking about as I go down in the drill bit into the dirt or up into the clouds, whichever direction you like? And so what I did was something that I do often and don't speak of. I made my last will and testament, and I put it on the audio. Why not? I usually write it down, but I talk about that in the little walk. So here we go, off up Mount Grief, as I go to my doom. Sub 10 degrees. It sounds colder than 9 degrees, doesn't it? Sub 10. It's almost a way of saying negative, but it tricks you in there. You can be positive and negative at the same time. Adds a little briskness to the notion of a 9. Oh, you can hear these frozen trees. Their old bones breaking. It's different kind of walk today. Hiking up. What is this mountain? Mount Mountain. I had to drive here. I have snowshoes, but I'm not wearing them. They're too small. You'll recall. It hasn't snowed in a while, and so enough. Hopefully enough walking has traveled up the mountain. I suppose it would be walkers rather than walking itself. The force of walking, independent of any living creature, set itself down upon the mountain like a highway. There's a sign up here. It's a sad name, I remember, this mountain. Makes you feel sorrowful. Mount Grief. Mount Grief. 2.1 miles to the summit of Mount Grief. Who would name a mountain that? Walking up a mountain in sub-10 degree weather, that might seem a terrible notion for an old man who walks sub-1 mile per hour, especially mountain. It's such a dreadful name, Mount Grief. For all these things would seem to conspire to bring about my end. But I am well dressed. It's interesting to me how a little pile of clothing, maybe weighs 3 or 4 pounds, can be the difference between life and death. Can be the difference between freezing to death and having a pleasant stroll. They're surrounded by these seemingly insignificant differences that change everything. For example, perhaps if I had no clothes, you needn't picture that. Think of it hypothetically, without any images. I might be dead in under an hour, standing out here. But dressed as I am, I can go for maybe two. No, I can go further than that. I could go at least until night. Sometime in the night, I'm sure I'd be overwhelmed. Maybe not. Maybe I could wander the cold earth in exactly what I'm wearing. Periodically, I'll stop and listen to this old cold forest. It sounds, I don't know if you can hear it, it sounds a suffering thing. Little whines and creaks and cracks. Like it'll never survive. Must be people that put clothing on their trees. Sweaters and maybe one long pant leg and knit scarves for them. You don't hear often about that. People can seem obsessed with their dogs or their cats. And they might be lovers of flowers or green thumbs or gardeners. They never seem to anthropomorphize the flora. Do people name their plants? Good plant names would be things like Agnes and Agatha, especially for rubber plants. All rubber plants are either named Agatha, Edna, or the males, Aberworthy, Agnes. Did I say Agnes? I love saying Agnes and Agatha. Such tormented names. But quietly tormented. The torment of silence. Being locked up in a library with no good books to read. Poor Agatha. Here's a birch tree. I'll name him Philip. Philip the silver birch. Here's a poplar. Tom. This is rapidly degenerating into a shepherd of leaves. Walking up, by the way. It's not exhausting because I am so slow. If you walk slow enough, there isn't much up in up. It's almost flat. It feels that way. The faster you go, the steeper it seems. Mine was the only car in the Mount Grief parking lot, which is sinister for a popular spot like this. You want to see that others are engaging in similar foolishness. I don't think it's foolish. I just think there'd be a perception that when it's sub 10, all you really should be doing is tending the fire. As I rise, the path is getting less and less trodden, narrower. You begin to see individual footsteps. So some have come this far and turned around. But not I, intrepid listener. It's a trick I learned long ago. Theta, I give the audience credit for the qualities you are at that moment inhabiting. So if you're speaking to them, if you're engaging with them, which is rare but happens, so if you're playing a figure who's falling in love, for some reason or other you get a chance to speak to the audience, you might say, "My dear romantic friends," and you provide them, you name them. You name them with the quality that you are then presenting for their consumption. Because it's true. What's mostly happening is their experience. You are building a house they're living in, but you are yourself not the house. You have a hammer and a nail, and you never lived there yourself. You just know what it looks like, or should look like, and you know how to build it. Narrower and narrower. Fewer and fewer. Less and less as I go. Higher and higher. I'll probably only go a mile or so up, and then there's a cliff-like clearing. And at that point, I swear to you, I will undertake the experiment of 1 hour without clothing. Of course I won't. Because nothing that I say goes. I am breathing harder. Simply because I'm trying to accelerate. I kept my normal 1.0. I'd be very nearly napping the ease with which I'd be going up. But I'm pushing it. Why is that? Slow down. For my entire life, I've had the desire to walk with my head held high. And I don't mean with any sense of pride. I mean because I enjoy looking around. But I almost always find myself staring down at the booty floor, the dirty road, the snowy path. So I love the vista quality of everywhere I go, but yet I cannot seem to get myself to stand in constant regard of it. My head falls always like a puppet. Let's go, puppet head. Suppose it's puppet neck. Head of a man, neck of a puppet. I'm getting mildly dizzy. I'm going to stop for a bit. Stop recording. I'll still keep living and walking, but may I lie down here in the snow, as the emergency personnel suggest you do when you get dizzy. They say lie face down in the snow until the dizziness passes. Try to sleep, they say. Take off your gloves, hat, whatever. Face down in the snow. Don't worry about it. Just go right out. So that's what I'll do. I always follow emergency protocol. It's just a habit. I don't remember where I picked it up. I've always had it, I guess. I'm very cautious and safe. I was born that way. So a little nap here in the sub-10 weather in the frosty snow out on a pass. No one's walking. All's well that ends like this. It's what I always say. YOLO. Is that it? YOLO. YOLO. What does that mean? I don't know. Something about dying. Oh, you only live once. Some kind of irony there. The hypotenuse of irony is sarcasm. I'm half out of my mind with dizziness, so likely this doesn't make sense. I'm still here. All right. Time to keel over. Do you ever leave your last will and testament? I'm always leaving my last will and testament. Little thing I like to do. It's because I keep losing the previous ones. I suppose it doesn't matter. Whoever it is that needs to find it will find it. Whichever one I've left, it's always the same. But I don't have a spot to put it. I don't have some last will and testament box on the front of the house. A safety deposit box. Maybe there's some place to file these things. Down at the library, at the police station. I really don't want to have a lawyer. So I leave them. I don't think I've left an audio one before. It's not macabre. Macabre. It's very hard to say macabre and get to the end of the word with any kind of elegance. Just kind of punches up there at the end, macabre. I tend to fade out because I don't know what to do. Macabre. It's a little R and an E tucked in at the end that dance out of the light. So really, I just leave it all to whoever wants it. That's all. I show in sleeves, being of sound mind and body, although not really feeling so good, and not thinking so clearly. Regardless, I mean, who is when you're doing such a thing? It's a preposterous notion. I'd suggest that most of the people who leave last will and testaments are nearly dead, and not at all in their right mind. So, there's always that going against it. And maybe that's why last wills and testaments are so contested. Because when they're being manufactured, the
The committant is just out of their minds and half out of their bodies. What good is it? But I leave it all to whomsoever they may be who stumbles past. Whoever wants whatever there is. But not to the government. Let's say not that. Not to any kind of great big gulping body that consumes without any real positive symptom on the other side. Just gets eaten up. Now I'd like someone to be able to use the cavern. My old Ford Galaxy Starliner. Keys inside. Sometimes it's in the ignition switch. Sometimes the car's idling and it runs out of gas. Now my car, maybe all cars are like this, my car seems to consume gas even when it's off. So I'll fill the tank up, drive home. It's not a far drive from the station, gas station, not some radio station where I'm working. Drive home, park, sometimes take the key out, sometimes let it dangle. Maybe that's a problem, I don't know. Then I go back and it's down to a quarter of a tank. So I suppose gas evaporates or the engine is always, even when it's not, running a little. Maybe there's some quiet engine mumbling, rum, 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 rum. I can't hear it, but gas is being consumed. That is why when I go to the gas station, I often think, well, how many times in the next month am I going to actually use this car? And if it's very little, then I won't fill the tank up, because I don't want all the gas to be consumed out there in the shed, in the car shed, from nothingness. From the nothingness of just sitting there. Which is how my own personal energy gets mostly used up, I suppose. But I don't want that to be the way with the car. I'm lying here, by the way. Did I mention that? And I stopped the recorder and then thought, well, and I looked around for a spot to lay down. It's very hard to choose such things when you're dizzy. And when you're dizzy, you don't think well. I suppose that's the main problem. Dizziness is a form of poor thinking. Going round and round inside your head. I'm talking in the same way that a dancer who spins, or a figure skater, or anyone who twirls, might grab hold of their magic spot to keep themselves from getting dizzy. That's never worked for me. I try that periodically. I try spinning, and then turning my head rapidly and holding on to a spot with my eyes. Then I lock on it as my body continues. My neck isn't very twisty, but that's never worked for me. Even when I was young and lithe, and I could spin with the best of them, I still got dizzy. I've always been susceptible to such spells. So this is nothing new. But when you get old and you're half on the top of Mount Grief, you wonder. Especially when you find yourself writing your last will and testament every other day, because where is it? Where's it gone? And where to put it? I put it on the table sometimes. By the bed. On top of me sometimes. It's just gruesome. I wake up. There's some crinkly thing on your chest, and you look at it, you can't even remember, and there it is, staring at you. I leave this and that to everyone. Is that a good last will and testament? Is that valid? I leave it to whomsoever finds it. It's sort of a Treasure Island testament. Treasure Island last will. Robinson Crusoe. Stranded on a desert island, whomsoever may come upon it. I think that's how Some of the Shackleton expedition people managed to get away to some remote campsite and perished subsequently, but I think that's what their last will was. Whoever comes upon our old cans and bones can have it. If I misspeak here and there, it's simply due to the dizziness, the quasi-near-death state that I perceive. And I don't mind dying. I have no trouble with it. Well, I have a little trouble, but it's not as much as you might imagine. Not as much as I might have imagined when I was younger. Because you get done with things, you get through it. You get to the other side and you know the ride is over, and that's all right. Why is it all right? Why is it all right? I'm sitting up. Why is it all right? You realize how you've done all these different things. You've seen all these movies and read all these books and met all these people, said all these things, made all these jokes, had all these thoughts. You've gone through the run of it. And you say to yourself, well, I don't really need to tell all those jokes or say all those things or see all those people anymore. Or not as much. It'd be nice, but it's all right not to. I don't have to go to Paris again. I don't have to go on any adventures. The idea of experience itself quiets. And one quiet. And death doesn't seem the unfortunate tearing away that it once seemed. A kind of bleak termination. It seems like the thing that happens at the end of the day. You've done the day, and you're tired, and it's late. Now, this is all, of course, quite alarmist, I'm sure, but not to me. It's just how it is. You get to be a certain age, it's coming. It's right around the corner, maybe with you right then. So you're there with it. I'm sure some people who are close to death try to pretend it's not there, but if you don't mind it so much, then you don't pretend. You expect it. You expect that visitor because they're already there, in large part. Death is not a thing that comes from across the ocean. Death is there with you all along inside. Not a disease. I wouldn't say death is a thing you're dying from all along, although it's poetical. It's more, what? A hook that's always been there, that eventually you'll hang your hat on. And you've always seen it as you've hung your hat all the other days, but there's that one last hook that's been there waiting. And there it is in the periphery. And it's a part of the whole hook arrangement, and that whole hook arrangement is part of the house, and the house is all you. And that house is all you've got. That's the place you live. From the skin in and from the skin out. You intend and you extend. You inhale and exhale, and that's how you touch the world and how the world touches you. I don't really like, though, that I'm on Mount Grief. That's a bit too much. Some resistance about that. Well, so now I'm getting up. I still don't feel very, very well, though. At this point, I don't know if I should keep going up or head back down. I haven't accomplished my minor goal. But that's just a bookmark that I've set at a page that I hope to read to. I don't really care if I make it or not. But I thought for the purposes of this recording, it might be nice to get to some scenic view. The big old cliff. I'm sure it would be much too windy to record. I'm rationalizing now. Backing out. Backing out. Dimming the lights. Shutting the door. Well, I'll let you know. I'll either be going up in a few minutes or I'll be going down in a few minutes. We'll pick up from that. Or we won't. That may just be the end of this one. It ends in my possible death and my possible ascent to the magnificent cliff or back to the lonely parking lot. And then I proceeded not to die or go up to the cliff. I survived with yet another instance of my last will and testament put down here for the first time in any kind of formal record. Of course, there are scattered sheets about my cabin, and these eventually get tossed or piled or burned. Those are the three activities I'm most comfortable with. In late afternoon, I seem to be just gripped with the notion of arranging things. That's when I do a little bit of cleaning. That's when I'll shuffle my papers around. I'll throw things away. Late afternoon, I don't know why, ball things up. I just tidy up. Not much, a little. I put in a tiny bit of effort every day. And I keep it looking somewhere in the proximity of not unimmaculate. It's rather dusty, rather untidy, but there's space. So, if you looked inside through the window, you'd think, oh, it looks all right. But then you go inside. I recommend you don't, unless I've died and you've decided you'd like to acquire my cabin. And then you can clean it up. You can find all my remaining last wills and last testaments. Keep them. Paste the walls with them. But anyway, I am tired, sincerely tired, and it is late, sincerely late. And I hope you'll join me again on the next The Radio Ghost. I don't know if the "the" is an official part of the title. I hope you join me again on the next Radio Ghost. It's tired. And I'm late. The old frozen fire turned out late. Tomorrow we'll slip through town. Side every turn up, thing down. But now it's time to sweep. It's tired. And I'm late. Untie your candles. I just lit the skates. We're sitting in sleepless light. Come dreams that were seeping right. But now it's time to sweep.
Hit a ball now.
It's tired.
down leaves, your frozen fire turn out late. Tomorrow we'll sleep through town, side every turn up thing down. But now it's time to sleep.